Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. It's Chef Tom Douglas.
And Terry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
And Katie O.
And I am chef owner of many of Seattle's fine restaurants, including the one we're standing above here, Lola, the Carlisle Room over across from the Paramount, and of course Palace Kitchen right here, one of our third restaurant, opened almost 25 years ago now. So it's
you're a very prolific restaurateur, Mr. Douglas.
Well, however you like to say it, that's what I am. And, of course, this lovely cooking school, Hot Stove Society, where we do our show on Tuesday mornings.
Great spot.
You can get tickets at hotstovesociety.com. Come join us. This lovely, lively audience is here this morning. They are ready to go.
Singing for their supper.
Singing for their breakfast.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of joints in town, Luke in Madison
couple joints,
Valley.
Like, I know marijuana is legal, but that's a little ridiculous.
Oh, did I say that the right way?
Good joke.
Okay, I have a couple of restaurants in the city. Luke in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle at the corner of 6th and Union.
That's right.
And Katie O just does nothing.
I do nothing, actually.
You're a Molly Moon head now.
Yeah, I'm over at Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream, slinging ice cream to the masses.
Love it.
That's what I'm doing.
Dixie cups.
Yes, very cute.
All right, we're going to do a dinner party using the same ingredient in every course coming up. I'm going to answer your culinary questions and quandaries. Juan Menez Oca is here to help us celebrate National Cabernet Day. He's from Intrinsic Wines and Columbia Crest. And, of course, we're going to go toe-to-toe on food trivia at the end of the show, 2 hours from now, or an hour and 45 minutes from now.
If you're counting.
So I'm looking forward to that because KDO's playing today.
I know. I always get a little bit nervous, but I do. I've grown
but
into
always
loving the competition of it all.
Yeah, you don't lose very often at that game, that's for sure.
Up
don't
next,
jinx me.
Let's just stop about how good KDO is.
I know. Let's stop, everyone.
Up next, Katie, let's take us through some ordinary to extraordinary.
Yes, this is where you take some ordinary dishes and make them extraordinary. And as we've been known to do lately, we take the food holidays, the national food holidays, and we're going to use that as our roadmap.
So what are the five holidays this week?
The five holidays this week are Spumoni fajitas, a personal favorite of mine. Sponge cake.
Spumoni fajitas?
Spumoni fajitas. That'd be a melty
wow
fajita.
Oh, boy, that's a whole new meaning.
You eat first, I'll watch.
That's real fusion food right there. Sponge cake, peach pie, and whiskey sour. Do you have a preference on where you'd like to go, what you'd like to make extraordinary knowing the holidays?
I think sponge cake.
Yeah, I was going to say sponge cake too, because it's that time of the year where the berries and everything is so available.
I would not have guessed that. I thought Tom maybe would go for a whiskey sour. And Terry, you'd maybe do fajitas. Just kidding. Let's do sponge cake then. That's on the 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make it extraordinary?
Well, first you buy a copy of Seattle Kitchen.
No plug there.
No, I have a delicious five-spice angel food cake in the Seattle Kitchen book. And we can put that recipe up online, Sarah, if you want to take a photo and put it on our Facebook page. But I love that cake. I love that it's unexpected. You know, sponge cake or angel food cake is so the same all the
right
time, right? It's just that simple
blend
white cake. And supposedly, I mean, not purposely so, I would say. It's using up some egg whites, and it's also going to show off the fruit that you're going to put
right
on top of it.
It's so, a vessel.
Right. So I take that sponge cake, and I add five-spice powder to it, and it's just really a regular recipe outside of that. And then I take all the egg yolks that I had left over from using the whites in the cake, and I make a crème anglaise,
mm-hmm,
and I do a little orange zest crème anglaise there.
And you use a little Grand Marnier?
No.
No? It's good. Just saying.
I'm staying in Asia.
That sounds nice, though. A little bit of the spicy notes in the actual cake itself. A little citrus.
It's fragrant.
Yeah, it does sound
That's what
very
I like about it. It's not spicy as in like
right
what you might
hot
think, right? No, it's not hot spicy.
Mm-hmm.
It's fragrant.
That's right.
For me,
right,
I think using fresh vanilla bean cut in half when you make your cake and get those little specks from the vanilla beans in
mm-hmm
there will really enhance that vanilla flavor. And also, once the cake is baked, cut it in half, make a very nice rich and very cooked caramel, and once it's cooled down a little bit, pour that between the two layers of the cake, and then use your cake as a vessel for pastry cream and then fresh fruit, peaches, blueberry, blackberry, whatever you want to use that's in season right now.
Mm-hmm.
But when you cut through that cake, it's pretty good. You get pastry cream, you get the cake, you get the caramel.
I would have any and all of these
disgusting bites.
All sounds tasty right
yeah
now.
Yeah, it does. Really does. Okay, where would you like to go next on our national holiday tour? Maybe I'm going to pick fajitas because I really enjoy them. Mm-hmm. I like that sizzle platter.
Mm-hmm. Well, first thing you have to do to make them extraordinary is actually get a sizzle platter because mm-hmm. I don't think many people have that.
That's true. Right? That is not a
Well, you can use a cast ironing pan. Most people
have
that.
That's what I'm saying. Well, that's a sizzle platter. That's what I'm saying. Right. A lot of people don't even have that, right? And you got to... The reason I like to keep my sizzle platter separate from my cast iron is I want that sucker hot.
Right. And hot, how hot are
we hot talking? So that when you...
So it cooks.
When you put the onions and everything on there, it literally sizzles and smokes and spatters mm-hmm. and all the good things. And sometimes if you do that to your good old-fashioned cast iron pan, you're going to burn the seasoning off of it.
Right.
Something you've maybe worked on for years and years. So I keep a sizzle platter as a side note for when I do that sort of thing,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It works on Chinese food. When you're doing like a honey black pepper short rib, Chinese style sizzling short ribs, or of that nature. So I keep that set up just for that sizzle because I'm going to put that on the open flame,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just going to let it sit there, and that it's going to get super hot.
It really is.
I mean, it's not going to get red like a wok might get.
It's also a great show. Come to the table really hot, put it on a piece of wood, make sure we don't burn the table.
Right.
You know, but it's a nice show to have it at the table, you know, finishing cooking at the table. Use good meat is my recommendation for fajitas. Sometimes you get nothing but those big nerve into a piece of meat and you're chewing on that for 10 minutes. That's not very good.
I like skirt steak.
Yeah, skirt steak is good. Flank steak, you know,
mm-hmm.
some of that nature of meat. Those are good for that. So.
And then, you know, Lodge is a famous cast iron pan
mm-hmm.
company,
yeah.
and they make this little oval sizzle platter that actually comes on a wood trivet. And that's what I have in the restaurants. I use that very same pan down at Lola as we serve our kebabs because, you know, we put the yellow sweet onions with the lemon on the hot sizzle platter.
Right.
And then we put the kebabs that are cooked on the grill right on top. And then we hit it with ouzo, which explodes. It doesn't really flambe because ouzo doesn't have a ton of alcohol.
Right.
You might get a little bit. But
that
explodes with that licorice steam.
Yes.
And so that is quite delicious. Ooh, okay, I'm hungry.
Man, we're hungry here.
All right. Coming up next, what's cool with being in the fridge and what's better off avoiding it? We're sharing our tips on what foods to store where on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society here in downtown Seattle. Came across an article, KDO, that had some tips on what foods you should or shouldn't put in your fridge.
I think that this is pretty important. I know that my personal small little studio apartment is very warm over mm-hmm. the last couple of mm-hmm. weeks. And so how you prioritize your fridge space is tantamount.
So you're saying two different things. We're kind of saying two different things because I think some people put food in the fridge that is better if it's not refrigerated. It's
Correct.
Better if you just eat it, like an mm-hmm. avocado mm-hmm.
or tomatoes.
And then other people put food in the fridge, to your point, in a way that is environmentally not healthy,
both
for you and for the food.
All the things. All the things are very important.
So let's go first about what foods you could eliminate from putting in the fridge so that you don't have excess food in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's talk about the other side of that.
I feel like tomatoes are the biggest one. I don't know that everyone knows this at this point, mm-hmm. but I know growing up as a kid, I feel like tomatoes were put in the fridge all the time.
Hmm.
And what do we all think about that?
We had a different childhood.
We probably, you know what? I think I could have guessed that without having brought up this tomato situation. I'll just put that out there right now. But yes, tomatoes, they just do not belong in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
They get a little mealy. They start losing their fragrance and deliciousness. What do you think about that, Tom?
I agree. Totally.
Totally agree. Except for when you're preserving them, is that correct?
Well, of course, yeah. If you've already dried them and have them in oil, or
mm-hmm.
if you've done some sort of processing into salsa.
But I always think that, I've thought about this in years since you've had the farm, is you have this great tip for taking whole tomatoes and putting them in the freezer.
Yeah, especially paste tomatoes.
Yeah.
So when I preserve those, we literally put enough for a batch of spaghetti sauce, basically,
mm-hmm.
maybe four paste tomatoes into a Ziploc bag, whole, freeze them just like that, no processing, and then when you pull them out, you saute your garlic, in a saute pan with olive oil, and you just put the frozen tomatoes right in, and they melt like ice cubes into your and make your sauce. And it's just a lovely, fresh way to do tomato sauce, especially if when you consider the alternative is coming out of a can.
That's right.
Which is not a problem. They're perfectly good, but it's just, I think, really special to break down those paste tomatoes.
Right, especially if you have a surplus of tomatoes, which some people really do. You know, a lot of people love growing tomatoes during the summertime and maybe have a glut that they can't deal with right away. So
freezing if you're living in an apartment and it's only one tomato, you still put it in the freezer and use it when you make a soup or when you make a stock. It's always a great addition to something of that nature, like a stock or a stew. You don't necessarily have enough to make an entire sauce for a pasta, but I think it's great because when you live alone, usually people have a small freezer box, so they don't have that much room. And that's also another place. You can still put it in the freezer.
That's right.
Same with any kind of leftover fruit that are going sour on you or bad, you don't have time to take care of it, just put it in the freezer. Use it a couple of days later.
Here's another one. Garlic, onions, and shallots. Let's talk about that. Out.
Yeah. Absolutely. Not in the freezer.
There's a couple of reasons, right? One, they stink up your whole fridge. And you know, things like butter or milk or anything that happens to be open will just soak up that flavor. Two is they just don't. They don't get any better.
They don't need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
They're meant to be in dry cellar, not in fridge.
But here's where I have a question as a consumer of these things. What about you see garlic cloves that are peeled, right? And you can buy them in the produce section. Those are refrigerated.
They are, because they're not protected
by the
skin.
It's a little bit like an egg, right? And they've already been refrigerated. And that's the issue with eggs and everything, things like that. If you buy the eggs straight out of the farm, straight from the chicken, it's never been refrigerated. You can keep your eggs out for weeks.
But if
it's been refrigerated for over a day, then you have to keep it refrigerated.
Well, it's the same reason why you see melons, whole melons, unrefrigerated at the grocery store, but you see cut melons refrigerated, right? You start the rotting process. As soon as you cut it, right, it's going to start.
Speed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With that, so onions and shallots, let's say your recipe only calls for half an onion or half a shallot. Mm-hmm. Do you feel comfortable sticking that in
the fridge?
Okay.
But you have to seal it up tight in a bag.
Yeah, you have to seal it tight because it will stink up your whole refrigerator.
Next one, sweet potatoes and potatoes.
Well, you never see them refrigerated at a grocery store or a farmer's market, and I would suggest you take that hint.
Look around the grocery store and see where they're storing it.
This time of year, you never see corn refrigerated. The only time you see corn refrigerated is I don't know why they feel like they have to have corn year-round, but they do. And you'll see it because it's been shipped from God knows where, Peru maybe,
to make it to
our grocery store shelf. So it has to be refrigerated. Right. And it's tasteless nonsense, so I just don't buy it.
You know, I will admit here on the radio show, I don't know. I know this rule about look around the produce section and see where it's placed on the shelves and then do so appropriately in your home. But weirdly, I've been putting corn in my fridge. I'm going to stop doing that. It takes up too much space.
Get over it.
I'm sick of putting corn in my fridge.
That's the other thing, too. This time of the year, there's a glut of vegetable and fruit on the market. And, you know, try not to overbuy because it's easy to do. You're at the market. You're like, I'll get a couple pounds of this, couple pounds of that. And next thing you know, you can't eat
the whole thing. It's so hard to not buy a flat of this, half a flat of that. It really is.
This is when you definitely need to have room in your freezer and places like this because you will need it. you won't get through the whole thing. And you're like, oh, my God, I don't want this. I don't have time to make jam or whatever, you know, so put them in the freezer.
That was my next point with stone fruit. I think that is an area at the farmer's market where we can get very excited. It's a beautiful product. It only comes out, you know, for a very short little span of time, and so you end up buying perhaps a little bit more than you intend. So if you can't get to it,
Have to process it because you know what's going to get to it? The fruit flies.
Yeah,
right?
The fruit fly will get to it.
They're going to make you crazy in your household.
But you know, if you buy three peaches and three apricots, you put them in a bowl, you put a towel on top of that bowl, and you're done. You don't have to do anything else. But you keep them outside. You don't have to put them in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Then if you see within 2 days and you're not getting through the fruits, cut them in small pieces, put them on a sheet pan or a plate, put it in your freezer, and once they're hot, put them in a bag.
All right, let's spend a minute and a half. We only have a minute and a half left on fridge organization, especially this time of year.
Yes, super important, Tom. So you just hit it because I feel like you're good at this.
Well,
but
I'm just saying.
Restaurants.
Yeah, we get inspected 4 times a year by the health department, so we know the rules. But a lot of people at home, they don't know the rules.
That's right.
And, so never, ever raw meats on top, right?
Yeah.
Never, ever a big pot of hot stock going into your fridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the restaurants, we have to chill everything at a 2-inch high maximum, and it has to be go from whatever that temperature was that you took it off the stove or out of the oven to under 38 degrees in 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you put it in your tight little fridge at home, and you put, let's say, a roasted chicken in there or a piece of prime rib.
Everything or, heats up.
Or soup or whatever it is. Not only does it heat up your whole fridge, and that particular, your home fridge doesn't have the firepower
right.
that a commercial fridge does, right?
It doesn't have the fan and everything that we have. To
but trim. Even so, it's going to take 24 hours for a quart of chicken stock to get below 38 in your home fridge.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got some questions, right? Now let's just say you go to a restaurant and you get sick. And you got to decide, well, did I make myself sick or did that restaurant make me sick, right?
Was it my chicken stock that was hanging out in that danger zone for 24 hours?
Yeah, mm-hmm. You just can't. And many fridges are set up with the produce drawer on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, you might some meat product might drip on top of that produce. But anything like that, even cooked meat goes above raw meat, right? So raw meat should be on the bottom of your fridge.
That's right.
And then your cooked meats and then your vegetables and things like, of that sort on top.
Anything raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you need space in your fridge. If you pack it in tight, the air can't circulate and you can't get your temperatures down. And now, with these temperatures we've been having this summer, at 90-plus degrees, when you open that fridge door, it's not like 70 degrees. It takes that much longer to recool your fridge, right?
So mm-hmm.
really important things. There's things, places online you can go to how to organize your
we
fridge.
You can read that Bon Appetit magazine.
Yeah. Coming up, Southern food versus soul food. Brick oven pizzas. We might be talking about food in the news on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. All right, it's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotaro, the chef in the hat.
And I am Katie O.
We're here with you for 2 hours today. Thank you for joining us. We're here every Saturday and Sunday on Cairo, or you can go online and podcast us right on your Cairo Radio app or Stitcher and have some fun while
that's
you're in the garden.
For 15 years. Wow. Man,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Plus now, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Food in the news, KDO.
Food in the news. This one is a big, big deal. This comes from NPR, but really it was in pretty much every news outlet. And I thought of you, Terry Rotaro, my dear friend, because Joel Robuchon, a giant in cooking, passed away.
He was a giant in cooking. I think he was the biggest star in French cooking for sure, but in many chefs' world, you know, looked upon as a godfather of cooking. So
incredibly influential. But I really did think of you because I think of Joel Robuchon as one of the forefathers of, like, really distinguished French cuisine. Was just curious to get your thoughts.
Well, my take on Joel Robuchon, for those of you who don't know, was a French chef who had a couple, well, he had like three-star Michelin restaurant. He was probably the most decorated 3-star Michelin restaurant in the world. But besides that, his upbringing and his training and everything was a little bit different of a road than most of, you know, Bocuse, Verger, all those big names in France have taken where... you know, he was very open-minded and definitely had an approach to cooking that was different than the big classic follower. So, you know, his take on French cooking was, to me, I thought he was very avant-garde and very open-minded. He had a lot of Asia. He went to Asia at a fairly young age and got really influenced by that. And, you know, he's been carrying a torch that a lot of French chefs were actually admiring because of the openness he had to the rest of the world, you know, mm-hmm. and not being like so just traditional French. So his food, I've had dinner at Robuchon many times, Jamin when he opened Jamin and all those different places he's had. I mean, the food has always been impeccable, you know, and to me that's remarkable to have a legacy like that.
Yeah, that was my favorite part about Joel was that the Atelier
Robuchon.
Love that more casual style. You know, that's right up my alley. And having gone to that in Paris and in Tokyo.
Sit at the bar. And
yeah, it was just, that's more much more my kind of eating. Those 3-star restaurants, I could take or not, mostly not.
Right.
But then he spoke to me as a chef, and I love that. So
right.
We will miss him terribly.
Very
his influence. Yeah.
We've lost a lot of great people in the culinary industry this year. So,
R.I.P., Joanne.
That's right. Okay, the next article we have comes from the New York Times, and it's called, Is It Southern Food or Soul Food? This was a pretty interesting article. It took two chefs that I would say create Southern food, and really just talking about the difference of where they come from, where do you have to be in order to create Southern food. I think we have this conversation in a lot of different ways. Most recently it came into, I think, social consciousness with what's appropriation of another person's cuisine, and what really determines if it's soul and Southern food. So I wanted to bring it to you two, professional chefs, and get your take. If you feel like there is a difference between Southern and soul food, and I know for me personally, when I visited Tokyo this past year, that being my ethnic heritage and roots, never having been there, part of why I love that trip so much for me is because it's really what I connect to as soul food. It's what I grew up with in my home. So being able to go everywhere and have that flavor that really speaks to my soul personally, that's how I kind of started to conceive of it and start to think about it.
Yeah, but that's not what they were getting at, though, right? Well, the more appropriate thing would be, like, what's Southern Japan food compared to Northern Japan food or other parts of the world. So I'm not...
No. It's both. I think it's a little bit of both. But
a little bit of both.
But,
so if, my take is that Southern food, it really depends on the intensity of the listener and the dreamer of wanting to eat that food, right? Because you can go into Southwest Arizona and have Southern Arizona food. I mean, it really is. But I think in general, the terms Southern food and soul food I think of as Black American heritage, and that it is, when I was in Atlanta, I had real, what I consider real soul food, pasty stuffing and mashed potatoes and white bread and lots of gravy on cheap cuts of meat. And that to me is the Southern Black tradition soul food. And then you get into the other kind of Southern food, which could be barbecue. It could be Southern food as in Louisiana. Which is French Black or French Black slave Caribbean kind of food.
Right.
So to me, there's a huge difference. And I think, kudos to the people that think about it and study the difference and celebrate the difference.
Now, here's the question. Do you, and again, this kind of brings us back to a previous conversation we had, who can cook Southern food? Who can cook soul food?
Who's allowed to cook
who's
it?
Allowed to
who's
cook
allowed?
It? Who's allowed to do it and who's allowed to make it legitimate?
Yeah. So I think that comes down to who's allowed to cook it and who's allowed to open a restaurant with it. Is that's probably the more appropriate
that's
question.
That's probably the more appropriate question. Yeah. And even if you take that food outside of that regionality, that part of the United States, you know, we still consider it that, but who can do that?
Yeah,
really,
exactly.
Ultimately.
So could I do and get away with what Eduardo's doing at June Baby, say? Probably not.
I mean,
but although I have Tanaka-san, but my partner's Japanese, there's some fine lines there, you know. Barbara Tropp, who I think is one of the best Chinese cooks I ever met, she was a tiny little Jewish lady, right? So, but she went over there, she studied, she wrote books, she did all sorts of things, and I have no problem eating her Chinese food. China Moon was one of my favorite restaurants in the country. So this cultural appropriation thing, I know it's a hot topic now.
Well, I think,
Chef,
I think
how
to
do
me,
you feel? There's a lot of
to
us,
me, to me,
a lot
I
of
think
us white Anglo-Saxon Americans that are trying to cook French food.
Well, to me, I think it's the authenticity. Whoa, how do you say that? Authenticity?
Authenticity.
No, authenticity. Thank you. That you have to follow in order to be successful at reproducing something like that. So you're taking something that has a very strong cultural heritage, and you're trying to do it. And if you do it carelessly, you're going to look like a schmuck. You know, you're not going to look like the guy who's knowing what he's doing.
Look at you using the Yiddish. Talk about
it's called cross-culturing at the right time.
That's
so
right.
I don't know.
You said it beautifully.
Katie, how do you feel about it? Do you feel... Uncomfortable going to a Japanese restaurant that's run by a white Caucasian type guy?
I personally feel like if you look in the back of kitchens, who's actually cooking the food is generally not where that cultural food is from. I mean, so much of our kitchens are from Latinos, frankly. And I've always thought of food as being the real connector between cultures, really. That's how you can love and know, and it's the gateway to loving more about that culture. Again, bringing up Tokyo, some of the best pizza right now in the world is coming out of Tokyo. Is it because it's a bunch of Italians running those places? No, it's a bunch of Japanese people. But to Thierry's point, I think they're doing it with a level of reverence. It's all how you carry it. You know, do you love it? Are you trying to bring something to the masses because of your passion around that particular cuisine? Right. So, no, I don't personally have those feelings. I don't expect a sushi chef to be Japanese. I don't expect Mexican food to always be cooked by Mexican people. I expect it to be cooked lovingly and with passion and made delicious.
I'm the same exact way. I think it's not about anymore. This is 2018. I mean, it's not anymore about who's cooking. It's how they're cooking. You know, it's like, how much salt do they have in what they're doing? You know, do they actually mean to do this, or are they just selling, you know, some southern dish because it's popular? You know, it's like,
there's another angle to this, I think, that's kind of interesting from a chef perspective, which is, let's say you want to do Cuban food. Like, how many of us right in this room would make Cubanos right off the bat, right? Of course, they don't really serve Cubanos in Cuba, right? And how many of us fancy chefs would try to take the most simple little roasted piece of chicken with potatoes or
lemon
and try and doll it up and make Cuban food something that it's not, right? It's beans and rice and chicken with gravy. It is just, so I think that's where we run into issues too, is when we try to take a cuisine that might not be considered high cuisine, like fancy French food or upscale Italian or something like that, but we lose its ethnic nature.
It's like I saw a restaurant doing a deconstructed boeuf bourguignon once, and I was like, you're messing with the wrong thing, buddy.
Well, again, I think cultural understanding and knowledge about where this food originates from is a very big deal. I think that's why what Eduardo is doing in a lot of ways is pretty interesting, because there's an educational piece to where the history of that food is coming from, simply just serving it.
I would say Eduardo's last name right now, but I don't remember it.
Jordan.
Okay. I just called him Eduardo.
Over at June Baby and Solare.
Yeah. It's getting a lot of attention.
Certainly is.
So, now that we've solved those worldwide problems.
Handily, no less.
Yeah. Intrinsic Wines with Juan Munez Oca is here. He also is the winemaker at Columbia Crest. We're going to talk all things Cabernet right in the middle of summer on Cabo Radio 97.3 FM. All right, we're back in the Seattle kitchen. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotureau, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Claudio.
Our audience is so lively today because they know that there might be some wine in their future.
Breakfast wine.
We have Juan Munoz Oca here. He is with Columbia Crest Winery. He also has the Intrinsic brand that he's under his tutelage. But we're drinking a couple of things. You know, Columbia Crest also owns Horse Heaven Hills, right? So over in Prosser, these are both right near our farm. Horse Heaven Hills is maybe just 5 miles from our front door. And up in Patterson is where Columbia Crest, with one of the largest wineries in the world, in the middle of nowhere. You're up on that big plateau up on the gorge there.
In the middle of nowhere in the Horse Heaven Hills in Washington.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so
that is almost the middle of nowhere.
Well, I guess Washington is somewhere, but it feels like when you're driving out to it, it feels like you're going to keep driving. You'll go by a few onion sheds, and outside of that, you don't see much else. Let's talk Columbia Crest Cabernet, and why we're talking about this is it's Cabernet, National Cabernet Day, August 27th, and I think sometimes people think of Cabernet in more of a heavier food, cold weather kind of environment, but really, it is good. I was just drinking it right now. It tastes pretty darn good in the middle of August. So tell us about Cabernet and its intensity.
I think Cabernet does a good job at playing out of the food and adapting pretty well to the dishes that you're having with it. And especially Cabernet in Washington. And I say especially in Washington because at the end of the ripening season, let's say the last week of October, it's warm enough for the Cabernet to ripen its tannins and like the phenolic composition, the color and the aromas. But it's not hot enough to add sugar. So the wines have a great balance. Right? So they're ripe and silky, yet they have a lot of freshness. And I think that's what clicks with people, especially when you have Washington Cabernet with food, right? So the acidity plays out with the dish, and then the silkiness of the tannins is unique to maybe any one region in the world. Mm-hmm. And they're tremendous value as well.
And that's really kind of the upside of being from Washington compared to, say, California, which has those hot summer days and nights, whereas we cool off here in the fall region. Mm-hmm. And like Napa Cabs can often be 15, 16% alcohol, which is too hot, too much for me, too hot for me.
I think that's where Washington shines. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those last two, maybe 3 weeks of October, when it's really, really cold at night. And so it takes like 3 or 4 hours for the grapes to actually heat up during the morning. So even if it's 70 degrees out at 10 o'clock in the morning, the grapes are still 50, 55. Mm-hmm. And I think that preserves a lot of the acidity. So the wines are naturally very elegant.
And just so you know, I'm not sure all of our listeners know, but the higher the sugar content, typically as you ferment it to dry, the higher the alcohol content.
Correct.
So that's why we love that balance. I say we don't think about Cabernet, Chef. I know you disagree maybe, but I say we don't think about it in the summertime. But what goes better with a big old grilled tomahawk steak or, you know, big something on the barbecue is
a nice bottle, or even a good salmon that you make with some red wine reduction. You could mm-hmm. do that in the summertime as well, or a red wine vinaigrette that you're making on your... You know, it still fits the red wine position. Mm-hmm. Cabernets, I mean, for me, Cabernets have different levels of structure. You know, some of them are a bit lighter. Mm-hmm. Some of them are a bit denser. Some of them are meant to keep, which most people don't do that because mm-hmm. we need to drink now. But I think it's... I have some very old Cabernet in my cellar of Washington State, Leonetti, Woodward Canyon, Culisida Creek. I tell you, those wines age beautifully. Mm-hmm. Merlot included, not just Cab. But I think they age very well, and I think it's a beautiful thing. We have a gorgeous wine state.
Juan, you're the expert here about cabs, so I assume you're drinking a fair amount of it this summer. What do you like to pair with this beverage?
I think of Cabernet as a summer wine simply because, I want to get out of my rosé bend.
And just a one big right. rosé bender. You got to well, serve them
rosé is between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m.
Thank
and then
you.
After that it's Cabernet.
That's right. That's
you
right.
mean you can't
civilize people.
You can't take out the rosé. You can't be drunk. Yeah. You can't start drinking Cab at 2 o'clock in the sunshine.
So the chef nailed it when he said, well, if you're barbecuing, mm-hmm. anything that you throw on the grill that has a little bit of char to it mm-hmm. pairs beautifully with Cabernet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you're right. So we make three Cabernets at Columbia Crest. And they are, so Grand States, H3, and then our Reserve. And then each one of them has a different level of intensity. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's days in which you're going to have Grand States with, let's say, a salad. They had a little bit of char to it. And then and maybe H3 if you have a pasta that's a little bit more hearty. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a Reserve if you save it in your cellar for a few years.
Right.
Or if you decide to drink it right away with a big old piece of steak. Right?
Yes, that sounds delicious. So can we talk a little bit more about the flavor profile of cabs? I know that all three of you are experts when it comes to this particular wine, but for those that are maybe less accustomed, what are you really looking for in the flavor profile?
So as a winemaker, you want to represent the variety in every bottling. And when I think about Cabernet, I think about a beautiful texture, so wines that are very silky, mm-hmm. so tannins that are evident, and that you can feel, yet they're very soft and high mm-hmm. quality. And then when it comes to the flavor profile of the wine, once you go past the oak, that it's obvious in the nose with a lot of vanilla and toastiness, a lot of like baked goods aromas, mm-hmm. You get a lot of cassis and dark fruits. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I try to find when I look for Cabernet. Maybe a touch of herbaceousness, mm-hmm. like a little bit of bell pepper. Mm-hmm. If you will, and that's what I look for in Cabernet, what I look for in a Cabernet that represents truly the variety and the place where the grapes are grown.
Beautiful.
I just got that cassis. And I misspoke earlier. I called this a Horse Heaven, but it's H3. I called it the Horse Heaven Hill. So these are both Columbia Crest.
Yeah. Correct.
And so, also a little bit of that cured meat. I like the dry cured meat that's smelling in the wine too.
Yeah, a little
like
bit of
salami.
Like savory tone to it.
You get that a little bit. Yeah. But definitely the berry of definitely in the front.
The other thing I would say is, and what I noticed in your profile here on this on my sheet is that you're using these concrete eggs now, And I think of that as being very old school, very...
Rhone Valley.
Rhone Valley, even big vats in Alba and Barolo and that area. So tell us about that. That's cool.
It's interesting that you call it old school. I remember, so my grandpa made wines in northern Spain. And I remember they were celebrating the day that they crashed all the concrete tanks and they brought in stainless steel as if they were going into the future. He will be very disappointed with me buying now concrete tanks. The point is that concrete is it's a wonderful vessel. Mm-hmm. So it allows air to go through the vessel into the wine. And so that's what oak will do to a wine as it's aging, right? So the tannins develop and the wine becomes silkier and softer. Yet it doesn't add any of the aromas that oak normally adds to the wine. So that
which
vanilla,
can sometimes be overwhelming, right? Over-oaked. Right.
Not only overwhelming, but at times it might mask the nuances that make that Cabernet from the Horsemen Hills unique and special.
Right.
And that might be the reason
it
why
it becomes
you're
a
after.
One flavor as opposed to many layers.
Correct. And so what concrete does is then allows that development of tannins without adding those masking flavors that the oak does. Mm-hmm. And then the other part that I love about concrete is you cannot sanitize concrete because it's porous. It's not easy to clean. And so you create this like microflora in the container that is unique to that block of grapes. So we ferment the same grapes in the same tanks every year, year after year. Mm. And so the yeast that comes from the vineyard with those grapes, it's what carries the fermentation.
That's awesome.
And so that's good to get like
building
a little bit of terroir
time,
into the wine and make wines that truly represent the place.
I love that. Juan Munoz Oca has been our guest from Columbia Crest Winery. He's the head winemaker. And I would suggest getting out there and buying a bottle of Columbia Crest Cabernet or the H3 for your summertime grilling.
That's right. Celebrate the national holiday.
It's time again. We're going to celebrate our favorite taste of the week. At home or out of town on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm joined by the chef in the chateau, my good friend Terry Rotaro. Katie O on the go is here also. I'm Tom Douglas. We're going to talk about our favorite taste of the week. But,
right.
We still have one more full hour. So don't forget, we've got our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia wrapping up this next hour. We're going to create a dinner party using a surprise ingredient in every course and tackle some of the questions you all have sent in to our Facebook page. I'm looking forward to that. They're always interesting questions. But first, we're going to jump into our favorite taste of the week.
That's right.
Of the last week that we were out and about, whether you made it or whether you had it somewhere.
I'll tell you right now, I have not been cooking in my house. It's too hot. I've been spending, personally, a lot of time eating out there in the world, but also eating a lot of cold things, again, to stay a little bit cool. And I will say I have been so fortunate to start working for Molly Moons at just the right time of the year because it's all ice cream all the time. And what that also means is I'm fortunate enough to be there for all their seasonal flavor tastings. And the most recent one we had is actually in preparation for the fall. We're going to be doing a partnership with the Pike Place Market and different vendors there. And they have come up with a honeyed ice cream with corn cake. And I think it might be one of my favorite flavors that I've personally tasted. It's a little bit somewhere between like eating cornbread slathered with like all that sweet honey butter. It tastes a little bit like cereals that I grew up with that I also really love, like corn cereals with milk. That was definitely by and far my favorite. And unfortunately, you can't get it right now, but you'll be able to get it soon. So that was my taste of the week.
Sounds delicious. Sweet corn ice cream we tried maybe, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago at Palace Kitchen. We loved it, but it just didn't sell.
It didn't sell. That's why sometimes it has to be seasonal.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom?
My favorite taste of the week, I made a... I have two, really. One is from the farm, so nobody can really get this except if you come to one of our restaurants. Jackie brought over the most incredible cantaloupe.
Oh, I love cantaloupe season at the restaurants.
And I just happen to have some beautiful Parma prosciutto in the fridge,
which
all sliced
so
thin.
Happened.
And it's just a classic. What a classic taste that is.
Yeah, but this when we were talking about that earlier, classic. You know, this is a kind of classic you can't reinvent well. you got to separate from that, or you got a big bad the prosciutto and melon is the ham and melon is a classic.
Yeah, it's just either good ham or it's not, and it's great fragrant melon or it's not. Yeah,
that to me is the clincher though. Is that so often people are using melon out of season? You see that dish on buffet tables or caterings in the middle of winter, and that melon just is not interesting. It's like
eating in Scotland, you see it in the middle of winter, like eating a potato,
like a slightly sweet potato. Mm. But when the melon is what I know it is coming from Prosser, with that salty ham and the fragrance and the floral nature of that cantaloupe, delicious. That sounds
the other
really
thing that she made this week, which I thought was quite delicious, just a little fresh. We had 2 ears of corn from Connie Crawford, our neighbor in Prosser, and just took it off the cob. Roasted some onions and some tomatillos. I had just made chicken stock last week, so I had that in the freezer. I just made a little fresh corn soup with chunked avocado and quickly sauteed spicy shrimp.
So was it hot soup or cold?
It was hot soup, and the shrimp was just barely cooked, and the cold avocado. And then the combination, and of course we had to do a little tortilla strips on top.
Of course you did. I have to say I'm a sucker for corn. This is very delicious sounding. Tina.
All right, Tina, you had a taste you wanted to share this week.
Yes, we had a lovely meal at Gather Kitchen and Bar in Ballard. And I chatted with the chef there, Chef Ryan Donaldson, about this incredible broccoli dish that he made for us.
Sarah, our associate producer, Joelle, also the head of large media here, we all just devoured the broccoli. Tell us, can you break it down a little bit without giving away the secrets? Because I imagine there's secrets in there.
Well, it's a nice blend of African and Middle Eastern flavors. So we take some miso and roast it with the broccoli with some lemon and onions. And then we finish it off with some whipped yogurt that we season with tahini and then just a little bit of za'atar spice to finish it off.
Okay. That's on my drive home. I'm going there.
It's very far from my house.
They also have the Mariners game on TV, so I like to stop for that sometimes. Terry, what did you taste?
My taste of the week was a surprising taste, which is for your surprise birthday the other day at the PBR at Palace Ballroom. Then all your summer campers put out for you,
wasn't
sir.
Wasn't that wild?
That was super wild and very, very nice and very sweet.
So thoughtful.
But my favorite part was, actually wasn't my favorite part, it came out, then your birthday cake was a Dick's Burger birthday cake. I've never seen that before.
It was a 3-tier Dick's Burger birthday celebration with sparklers that came out. All these people had just eaten dinner all night long, and then next thing we know, we had 100 Dick's Burgers on a 3-tiered
And these people just had good
platter.
Food all around the Palace Ballroom. And then this came out. I was like, I'm probably not going to eat one of those. And then there was a cart.
There's the snobby chef coming out again.
Not snobby. Just, you know, if you don't have to eat it, you don't eat it. I mean, that's just the way it is for me. There was a cart with a prime rib that was getting sliced and just served with a little sea salt in your plate, which was, I thought that was awesome. Mm-hmm. So suddenly somebody came up with a genius idea to open the Dick's Burger. I think that was Mr. Douglas that did that. And put some prime rib in between and close back the burger and eat that. And man, to this day, I've had Dick's Burger a few times. I've never really found, you know, I wasn't born here, so I was never fond of the Dick's Burger. But if they start putting prime rib like juicy like this in it, I'm in it.
That's it. Just
they must
simple
want,
prime
they
rib.
They might want to listen to the app, you know, the people like me who I'm not sure about the Dick's Burger, man. I'll tell you one thing. That was delicious.
That was Bruce Miyahara who actually started that trend on Sunday night. And my favorite part about that trend was Terry went over and he was just over the top, over the moon with his prime rib Dick's Burger. And he went to try and said, Kathy, his wife is sitting at the table. Let me get you one of these. And she just looked at him and with vomit in her eyes. There is not a chance. She just looked at him. Not a chance I'm eating that. I'll eat some plain prime rib. But so now we know where Terry gets some of the snootiness when it comes to American trash food.
Well, my wife never gets it.
Maybe some of it comes from Kathy.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. My wife never gets it, so I don't have to go through it. Mm-hmm. It's also a matter of taste. You know, some tastes work and some tastes don't work.
I love that I came in today and Terry was like, did you have that sandwich? Did you have the sandwich with the prime rib?
I was impressed. I was impressed by something I never even thought about.
Yeah.
If you put a beautiful pink slice of prime rib with sea salt in the middle of a okay burger, you get a great burger.
All right. Up next, a dinner party using the same ingredient in every course. And, of course, you're going to host it at Katie O's house on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's happening in here. Everyone got their breakfast sandwiches. They got their hot coffee and tea. They're drinking Cabernet. It's a wild day here at the Hot Stove Society.
And it's only 6 a.m.
That's right. Yeah. Coffee, Cabernet, and breakfast sandwiches. It's a perfect trio.
Let's have a dinner party. Since we're all eating and drinking, let's increase the level of fun and have a dinner party.
That's right. This is a dinner party where I invite you to do all the cooking. It's at my place. I like to invite a special guest, and we use one ingredient for every single course. This week, the special ingredient that you will be utilizing is pepper jack cheese. Spicy pepper jack cheese. Mm-hmm. So our guest is going to be a spicy jack. Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Right? He's a spicy Jack.
I'm back.
There it is. You know the one sitting courtside.
You can't handle the truth.
Beautiful impression. Yeah. I'm surprised no one's called you from Hollywood to do your take on
I like the Shining when he's in the Shining. It's pretty scary.
Anyway.
So, what you're going to do.
Jack's fussy, though.
Do you think?
I think we have to invite Jack and Kobe Bryant at the same time because he's a big Lakers fan.
He is. And you know, fine. I like that. I like that idea very much. I'm sure my husband would like to invite Kobe Bryant over for dinner too. So this works out really, really well. Who wants to take on the appetizer and cocktail course?
I start with the appetizer. You want to take the cocktail? No.
He walks away from the mic
entirely. He goes like this. Jack Nicholson doesn't drink. That would be a nice joke. He probably wants his drink not to be messed with. That would be my guess.
Maybe.
Don't touch that. I just want my whiskey. My guess is he drinks bourbon with one ice cube.
You think he's a bourbon guy?
Yeah.
All right. What are you going to make?
We're going to make, this is a time of the year where we can shine here in Washington. I'm going to make a watermelon salad with...
For your cocktail?
No, for the appetizer. I'm making the appetizer. I'm not making
the
cocktail.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go with cocktail first. I'll go with cocktail then.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So you're back on cocktail.
You were just going to skip over. You can't skip over cocktail.
I'm not skipping over, but I think Jack's going to want it to be pure, like just a bourbon.
Dude.
No?
No. You can't do that. You have to have Jack cheese in every course.
Well, you just make little Jack cheese cube and you put them on the tray, the old-fashioned
way. So we're going to do pepper vodka.
Okay.
And then we're going to make our own little Vienna-style weenies.
Okay.
But we're going to add pepper jack to the Vienna-style weenie. And then we're going to go to the store and we're going to get croissant dough in the can.
Oh, my God. This
make
is very
pig in the blanket.
We're going to make pepper jack pigs in the blanket.
Ow.
To go with our pepper vodka.
The king of trashy delicious, Tom Douglas.
All right. Thank you. Now you can go on your salad.
Well, I'm going to bring it back the other way and make it clean for the appetizer.
Okay.
I'm going to have a nice little watermelon salad. I think a nice little watermelon salad with some diced pepper jack in the midst of it. Maybe some sour grape. There's grapes on the market that are starting to show up. A few of those. Couple toasted pistachios. And lots of fresh herbs. We have tarragon and basil on the market, or in the season, I should say. Julienne all that together, drizzle with some beautiful olive oil, a little bit of sea salt, because that pepper jack is not very salty, and some cracked pepper, and call it a beautiful, beautiful little salad just to start. Kobe's going to go.
I love how that Jack only drinks straight whiskey, but then he'll have a nice little fragrant watermelon salad afterwards. You're speaking out of both sides of your Jack Nicholson mouth.
Jack's been with some very distinguished people in his life.
He's a multifaceted Renaissance
man. He's been
with
some very well-educated woman.
All right, Tom. Your
entree.
Next. Entree.
I got to say, I did a weird thing the other day. I've been trying to clean out the freezer because this is the time of year when you put all new things in the freezer. So I was trying to clean out some things that I had in there.
I need to take your cue on that.
Yeah, do you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I have very large freezers.
I have a very small one.
I know. Anyway, I had a 5-pound duck in the freezer that I had bought. I love to keep a duck around. I always keep a rabbit in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
Keep racks of lamb in the freezer. I like little things like that. So
I have a couple of leg of lamb in my freezer.
Do you?
Always, yeah.
So... I took the duck, and it was too late to thaw it. It was frozen like a rock. I took the duck, and I literally put it on the charcoal grill, like a five-pound football frozen solid. And I had about 5 hours to cook, and so I dampered down to about 275, 300 degrees, and I slow-roasted the duck. And about 2.5 hours into it, I actually got to the point where I could open it up and pull the neck and the gizzards out.
This feels like a
it's
dangerous
called the money bag. Yeah.
And then for the next 2 hours, I just let it still continue low and slow. I had a pan of potatoes underneath of it, these beautiful Jersey purple gold potatoes. Mm-hmm. And the duck just dripped on those potatoes, and it just got low and slow and finished. And I made a pepper jack and duck quesadilla out of it. I took the skin off the duck and made cracklings out of it. And then I used the meat, shredded the meat, put the meat in the quesadillas, put the pepper jack cheese in the quesadillas, and I finished with a little crackling salad on top with cilantro and basil.
Okay.
Just wow.
Saying. That is an
just
unexpected.
Saying. Just saying. Maybe a little white onion salad on the side.
Just saying.
Yeah, just saying.
Everyone, wow. When you...
You know, if you have 5 hours...
Put that in your taquito and smoke it.
If you have 5 hours to cook, you should thaw the duck first and then
I couldn't.
There's not
a chance. No. It would have taken 3 hours to thaw.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have time to cook it.
I can't wait for everyone to send us pictures of their frozen ducks on the grill. That'll
and,
be a good
and going, it's been 8 hours and it's not cooked yet.
All right, Terry, you have a little bit of a challenging moment here.
I'm going to do macerated figs and shredded pepper jack with that and make like a fruit salad with cheese on it and lots of chopped shallots. Then I'm going to fry, not chopped but sliced. I'm going to fry the shallots and put that all over those crispy shallots right into the salad. Figs, pepper jack, and salad.
Tom is just shaking
his head at you. I think Jack is going to barf right now.
Why?
Because what you should have done is make fresh popcorn, dehydrate your pepper jack cheese, grind it up, and make pepper jack cheese popcorn for dessert.
That's not a dessert. That's a tiramisu during the movie when you're watching The Shining. Ah, jeez. That's not a dessert. I want a dessert. I mean,
which one is Jack going to like better? That's the question. I've had to really – you're struggling with pepper jack today.
Well, it's not, it's not something I eat, so...
I was going to say,
there's a shocker.
This is an ingredient that is maybe not native to French cuisine, and maybe not in Thierry's fridge very often.
Can I say something? It's not native to anybody's cuisine. I hate to break you the news, but pepper jack is just native.
I think of it as California cuisine.
Maybe of 7-Eleven cuisine.
How dare you? How dare you bring pepper jack into 7-Eleven?
They do some good cuisine. Whenever I go into 7-Eleven, they always have something cooking. I see those things rolling around.
Yeah, and they came out of the freezer rock solid.
Exactly.
And then they put them on the little rollers.
I mean, they're cooking away.
I think Jack Nicholson would be rolling his eyes at the both of you right now.
We couldn't tell. He'd have his sunglasses on.
That's a good point. I think he'd do the one eyebrow raise. That's how you would know. It's like he'd be giving
it'd probably
you
go up on both
eye.
Of you in my next movie. That's probably what he would say.
I bet you couldn't tell who my favorite co-actress, like leading actress with.
Diane Keaton.
Nope.
Oh.
To Jack Nicholson.
I always have a crush on her. Helen Hunt.
Oh, yeah. Helen Hunt. Mm-hmm. Is it? What was that movie called?
I don't remember,
as
but I remember her in the Hurricane movie with the Hurricane or Tornado Chasers.
Yeah. Talking to the
yeah.
That all right.
Just gotta say.
Well,
she's awfully nice.
We kind of forgot about Kobe Bryant and all of that.
Oh, Kobe!
Sorry,
have a Kobe
buddy.
Kobe cheeseburger. A Kobe beef cheeseburger.
I bet he's heard this one before.
That's, I think we're going to do a different dinner at a different time.
Up next, questions from you, our trusty listeners on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in the hat.
And I am Katie O. And I'm here with questions from our listeners. We went to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, and we asked you, what is on your mind? How can we serve you? How can we help in the kitchen in particular? And so we've got...
It's like the Butterball hotline at Thanksgiving, but we have it all year long.
All year long. 365, whatever the question might be. Elizabeth McCabe McCullough is an old friend of the show. Terry, you might remember her. Years ago, we ran a contest to take some listeners out to dinner with
us. Oh, yeah.
It was the Holly Smith Cafe Juanita pop-up.
Sure.
And her husband flew all the way out from the East Coast to have dinner with us. And we were shocked. No one has ever flown so far away to eat, at least with me. That's for sure. So hello to Elizabeth, and she would like to know any grape leaf recipes to share.
Grape leaf recipes. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the classic tomates, right?
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
I would. One thing you can do is instead of using rice, you can use a different grain. You can use farro, or you can use sampa. We know, like toasted barley fermented. Those always. It's a nicer grain to use. I mean, not nicer, because I'm going to have everybody telling me it's not nicer.
I like to use it. I'll take it. Again, in my Seattle Kitchen book, I have a beautiful ling cod. So any sort of fish, white fish.
Mm-hmm.
I made a little fig butter with ouzo and lemon, and then put that on there, wrapped it in grape leaves, and then put it on the charcoal grill. So the grape leaves get nice and charred, like kind of in the same way that maybe a banana leaf taco would, right?
Or, right.
Banana leaf, it's not a taco. It is a...
We know what you mean.
Tamale.
Anyway, so same idea. The problem is, though, that the butter does want to melt and drip through, so you have to be careful not to create a flame.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really delicious, and it's a fun way to use grape leaves.
Yeah,
I use the ones out of my backyard. I just give them a quick blanch right off my vines and go from there.
Yeah, and many people will say, why do you use a grape leaf? Why don't you just put it on the grill by itself? Well, it does actually bring a very nice flavor to the dish. You know, it's got a very strong grassy and then a little acid to it that goes... Like if you wrap
especially
a piece,
the jarred ones, right?
Yeah,
they're almost pickled.
Right, and if you put a piece of fish in there, it would definitely create another layer of flavor you don't have with just grilling the fish.
All right, Elizabeth, let us know what you end up doing with all your grape leaves. We have Isaac from our audience who was brave enough, as we asked anyone if they had a question, to come up. Isaac, tell us a little bit about yourself. Are you a home cook?
I am.
Are you a professional cook?
No.
No. Okay, perfect. What is your question for the chefs today?
So I have two young kids.
Mm-hmm.
Both me and my wife work. Any tips or tricks to get food that they will probably eat as well as be healthy and something that they will enjoy?
Boy, the healthy part, I'm out.
You're out.
Now you're down to one chef.
My solution is tell them that's the only thing for dinner. Next meal is in 8 hours, so choose to eat or not.
Yep, that
see
is
what happens. That's the other solution.
That's the French way.
We're very kid friendly. You know what's really popular right now is to figure out how to get vegetables into mainstream foods. Yep. So you'll see in the marketplace these days, you'll see kind of a mac and cheese in the marketplace, kind of pre-made, but it has a cauliflower. 20% instead of all the cheese sauce. It's got 20% cauliflower. Carrots and nice roasted carrots that are cooked down into a tomato sauce. So you get those veggies in with your tomatoes, your tomato sauce. And the kids don't even know it. Although, if your kid doesn't like carrots, we might just have to put them down.
How old are your kids?
9 months
and 3.
So kind
to the guests.
9 months and?
And 3 years old.
Ah, they're very young.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what do they like to eat?
Our daughter, Audrey, loves mac and cheese, obviously, hot dogs. She does like broccoli, raw, not cooked. Carrots, she loves that.
Uh-huh.
And then our youngest, Paul, is just kind of experimenting with
9 months,
some of the
soccer. He's still very young,
Did your kids, Tom, Thierry, were they food lovers off the bat, or were they a little bit finicky, and how did you deal with that if they were?
I don't think they were finicky. I think they were, you know, again, McCarthy would cook dinner and set up the setting of the table and all that stuff was very ritual every day. And then they would sit down and, oh, I don't like that. Well, it doesn't matter. You got to try it at least once before you say you don't like it. Because that's
But there's no kids. Second. You never made a second dinner.
No. Never, ever, ever, ever. That's against the rule of the house. Mm-hmm. You make one dinner, that's what's for dinner. And again, I was kind of joking when I said next meal is in 8 hours. But, you know, the bottom line is, you know, if you don't like this, it's okay. You're allowed not to like it, but you have to try it. That was the rule. And then why you don't like it? Blah, 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 whatever they come up with, which is just about anything. And then a week later, they're like devouring the same exact ingredient because they forgot they didn't like it.
Because
that's all it is. It's just like, I don't like it. Oh, I got something out of my parents. You know, it's just, a lot of it is attention driven, you know, and I think with kids. And there are certain things you don't like as a child, just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, there is a lot of attention driven, I think. So
the other thing I would say is you're probably out of baby food now, or are you still in you're not pureeing still, right?
For our youngest, we're just coming out of baby
just food. Coming out of that. But I would say try to add the Mediterranean diet to your own baby food. So let's just say you're making pureed peas, right? Add olive oil, add a little Reggiano Parmesan, add a little fresh tarragon or mint or basil, and expand that flavor profile at a young age with healthy things. And I think that, I'd be shocked if the baby didn't love a little salty Reggiano in
it's,
their
and
in
it's
their
a lot
peas,
e-
right?
It's a lot easier when they can't talk back or argue.
As soon as they go to scream, just shove another spoon in there.
You know, 3-year-old, they will fight with you to death. But a 9-month-old, you know, you introduce them. And you see it by when you feed your kid. You see if they like it or not. I mean, you know, they're not going to play any game. They're not doing the game. They're doing the taste. So, like Tom said, if you go moderately into introducing chopped herbs and, you know, light cheese and so on and so forth, you'll get the reaction very quickly. And then it develops their palate. And by the time they can talk and argue with you, they won't argue about the things they like.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you, Isaac.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, the next one comes from Jennifer Clausen, and she would like to know, sometimes I am a lazy cook and just want a simple pasta with cheese sprinkled on top. Many times the cheese balls up and gets rubbery. What am I doing wrong? Is it the type of cheese, temperature? This is my perfect comfort food. Please help me. So we don't know what kind of cheese. Oh, we do know what kind of cheese
she's
using.
Sounds like mozzarella.
Yeah. She uses cheddar, pepper jack, and Parmesan. Whatever is on hand. So I think that might be part of it.
In her pasta?
In her pasta.
Well, that might be the reason it balls up, because it's a very soft cheese. So, you know, you melt it. Well, first of all, grating it is not exactly easy to do, because it stays in clump when you grate it, because it's soft.
I think the way around that would be maybe if she wanted to make a bechamel or a mornay out of those, and then putting that on top of her pasta.
Make her a little cheesy sauce. Mm-hmm. Or I kind of like mozzarella, like in a tomato sauce. I'll put little chunks of mozzarella that I kind of want to stay a chunk but still warmed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll finish with Reggiano, something that's a grating cheese that will spread out and separate.
Yeah. So there's ways. Sometimes it's okay to have it clump a little bit depending on your vibe. All right. The next question comes from Sandy Russo. How do restaurants dispose of oil that has been used for frying? I do not want to dump it down the sink and end up in the Puget Sound.
Well, it won't get that far, Sandy. Don't worry. It's going to clog your pipe first.
So let's talk about the first one. What do restaurants do?
Restaurants, we all have grease bins or barrels or some sort of retrieval system that gets picked up weekly. And it is goes into biofuels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we've actually had people come by in their little VW camper or something wanting to have our fryer oil because they're going to use it for their fuel.
Yeah.
So that's what we do in the restaurant. At home, I always put it into a plastic container, put it in the fridge if it's animal fat that I don't want. Like, I'm always saving duck fat and chicken fat to cook with.
Bacon fat, all that good stuff.
But if it's animal fat, like maybe the fat off of a beef stock or something, I just put it in the fridge, wait till it's hard, then I put it in the garbage. Worse comes to worse. If I'm deep frying, I'll save my container where maybe you need a quarter or two of fat.
Mm-hmm.
And after I'm done, I'll just pour it right back into that container, put the lid on, and then put it in the garbage.
Right. That's probably the most reusable.
I put mine in the compost bin. I let it get it cool like Tom does in the fridge. And then I put it in the compost bin. Then I throw away every week so they come and pick it up. So
really?
Yeah, but you can't put fryer oil in a compost bin unless you have it sealed somehow.
Well, yeah, but once it's cold, if you get it really cold, you can just it's in glump. So you put it into your compost bin.
I know, but in your compost bin, it gets hot. So well, I guess my question is, what kind of fat are you using that's going to solidify at that temperature?
Well, I mean, any kind of fat like
beef fat,
duck fat or bacon fat, all that kind of fat is what I put in the compost bin. I mean, I don't really fry that much with oil. I usually keep my oil for a while, and once you have a lot of frying oil, it is an issue for sure.
I said
if you can put it in a compost bin, it's actually a better place than in the garbage.
Okay, we have 1 minute. Really quick question. It comes from Deborah Cahill. When is the best time for peaches, and where are the best peaches? My favorite fruit, she says.
Now.
Yesterday and tomorrow.
And, for the average person, I would say either the farmers markets or Mecca Market has a great peach program this time of year. So check them out.
There's a nice truck in Madison Park that's on Madison almost every day selling. He was selling cherries, now he's selling peaches, apricots.
But you have to trust him.
Well, yeah, right? of course. And he comes from Eastern Washington as well.
All right, up next, it's Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Time for us to take Katie out.
How
on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. I'm still tasting the mustard on my breakfast sandwich.
Is that a good thing or
a
bad
good thing?
Okay, good.
Good thing. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia, where Terry and I gang up and knock Katie out of the match.
Mm, that is an ambitious talk, Tom.
You and I can do it. We can do it. I'm older now. I'm older and wiser now.
Okay.
Well,
I had a birthday last week.
In that case, I'm tagging along.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll just see about that. As Tom said, I am your opponent today, so that means Tina Knoll, our producer, will be administering the quiz. Take it over, Tina.
All right, you guys. Here's how the game works. Each of you gets five questions. Whoever gets the most correct is the winner, and whoever gets the least answers correct is the big loser. And that loser has to give something away to a member of our audience. Today you'll be playing for Isaac, who's right here at the Hot Stove Society audience.
That's right.
He asked an important question about his kiddos, so we're playing for him. Katie, if you should lose the quiz today, what would you give to Isaac?
Well, Isaac, I don't know if your three-year-old likes ice cream. Kids are known to
broccoli
hate
or ice cream.
But I'm going to give you and your family a $75 gift card to the Molly Moon's ice cream shop.
That's so
you can
a
have
lot
some
of ice cream.
Maybe
That's
you can get a little cute ice cream tea for your kid. Maybe an ice cream soup. I don't know. All the fun stuff.
All right, Chef.
I'm going to give a brunch for... I mean, you have two kids and a wife. For the four of you at Luke on
brunch
a Saturday
for
or Sunday.
At Luke. Wow. Chef Tom Douglas, what will you give away on the rare occasion that you can...
Well, I think children like to stay up late, so I'm going to give a midnight supper.
They're always in a great mood the next
candy,
day.
A whole bunch of candy.
A midnight supper for the parents on date night at the Palace Kitchen. $100 gift card to the Palace Kitchen so that you can go out and get a babysitter with the money you might spend on dinner instead.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That sounds awesome.
So no matter what happens, Isaac is definitely a winner today. Who would like to play first?
I'll start.
Chef Thierry Rotureau.
Yes.
What round bottom pan, traditionally made of carbon steel, is designed for quickly cooking small pieces of food over high heat?
A frying pan? I don't know.
Wok. We were looking for a wok on that one.
I was totally into the French steel pan. I was like,
I
was not thinking of the wok.
We're supposed to be ganging up on her.
Oh, sorry. Okay, let me wake up.
Keep on this path.
All right, you have four more to go here. I think you can get them all.
A wok.
Which contaminant is more likely to be found in fresh water or coastal fish, PCBs or mercury?
PCBs.
Correct. There you go. You're on the board, Chef. You're on the board. What stovetop cooking technique is a French word meaning to jump?
Sauté.
Yes. Nicely done.
Thank goodness.
Tough one.
I went to France and I studied for 20-some years, so I should know.
Glad you got that one right. What ingredient added to water is recommended as a rinse to help remove germs from fresh produce? Vinegar, soap, or salt?
I'm going to go with vinegar.
Correct. Nicely done. That's 3 out of 4 correct. Your last question, Chef, is what stew is most likely to appear on a Kentucky Derby Day party table?
Oh, no.
I've been there many times. Go ahead. What stew?
What stew is most likely to appear?
A whole stew? No, I'm just kidding.
Kentucky Derby Day party table. I've never heard of this.
You've never heard of it?
Oh, nope.
Good luck.
And she's from Texas, so...
It's traditionally a thick stew of mixed meats and vegetables. What's it called?
Oh, like a stew.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't say.
Stew. Tom, any idea? I'm going to call it the Kentucky stew.
No, burgoo.
Burgoo.
How do you spell it? How do you spell it?
B-U-R-G-O-O. Burgoo.
Oh.
It'd take a long time before I'd eat that stew.
Yeah, well, it sounds gross.
It sounds like we all learned a little something.
Yeah, we most certainly did.
Yeah,
all right, Katie, would you like to go next?
I would.
Katie, true or false? Oils are fats that are liquid at room temperature.
True.
Correct. Katie, that is correct.
That's a slippery slope.
Got another true or false one for you, little lady. In 2010, McDonald's and the Italian government teamed up to launch the McItaly burger. Is that true or false?
Oh, man, I wasn't in Italy in 2010. This is going to be tough for me. I'm going to say true.
It is true. It was topped with artichoke spread, Asiago cheese, and lettuce. Persillade is a mixture of what two ingredients chopped fine?
parsley. I'm going to say lemon zest.
It's actually parsley and garlic.
Dang it.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. Question number four for you. Which type of tuna grows the largest? The largest. Albacore, bluefin, or big eye?
I'm going to go with the one with the giant eyes. Big eye.
Nope.
No!
Bluefin. Sorry. It can grow 1,500 pounds with the bluefin.
Okay.
Katie, that was two correct and two incorrect. Uh-huh. You have one more question to
tie with me.
Chef
okay.
Terry Rotrow.
All right.
True or false, head cheese is not a cheese at all, but
it's not a cheese.
Sausage made from intestines of an animal.
Is it a cheese or not is the question.
It's not a cheese.
Correct.
That's not correct.
The answer was false. That's correct. Okay. Tom, you need to get more than three correct in order to win this
quiz. That should not be hard today.
Quiz. Your first question, true or false, pine nuts are found inside the cones of pine trees.
Sure, why not?
Yep. All right, Tom, which plant was not eaten before recorded history? Celery, potato, or banana?
For recorded history.
Which plant was not eaten before recorded history? The answer is actually celery.
Celery.
That's a weird.
That was a dumb answer.
So stupid.
On my part.
Dumb. Tom, true or false, at high altitude, water boils at a lower temperature.
We've had that true.
Before. Correct. Question number four. Which oregano will have a more intense aroma and stronger flavor, fresh or dried?
Dried will, because it intensifies the...
Okay, ask him a really hard one.
You are now tied. It's a three-way tie, Tom. You got to get this one right to win the quiz. True or false, the banana tree is not a tree, but the world's largest herb?
False.
The answer is true. Banana's
a type of herb?
Three-way tie.
Wait. You have 2 3/4.
Yeah.
How dare you? I see a plus next to that question.
Y'all ready?
Y'all ready for this?
It's a three-way tie, which means we are going to ask a tiebreaker right now. Whoever slaps the table first gets to answer the question. All right, here we go. Sarah, are you looking? What step before baking creates the thick crust on a well-made chewy bagel? Chef Tom Douglas.
Boiling.
For the win. Boiling is correct. Tom is the winner.
Wait, hold on.
One more. Let's see who comes in second place so that we can determine our prize for Isaac.
Or if you weren't so cheap, you could give Isaac both of those.
Or?
No, hold on. I'm cheap.
Terry wants to.
I want the question.
All right, you two. Which is not a crustacean? Shrimp, oyster, or crayfish?
Oyster.
Correct.
Right. That means I'm the loser.
Yes. Molly, the ice cream party, Isaac. $75.
Ice cream party.
If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Tina Noll at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz, and our sound engineer is Sean, don't call me Del Torre. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. It does come with a breakfast sandwich and hot coffee. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.